Yes, I was just told something that I very well know, and that is that though I was supposed to get on to Hammarskjöld last evening, I just sort of got into some mention of Hammarskjöld at the very end, because we were working on this element of co-inherence. And just to pick up there and then go into another introduction and really get on with the business. This is the one specific use of the word that I know in Hammarskjöld's markings. And it's a very ambiguous thing, but it's there. It's one of those little mysteries I would like to seek out. But I know no way of finding out whether Hammarskjöld ever had an opportunity to read anything of Charles Williams. But here it is, and it's from 1950. I've been working with about three different editions of Hammarskjöld, which shows how fast printings are sold out, and then they go to a different binding, different publisher picks up and produces it. And it's murder, because my students have to buy what's available, and then I have to go and revise my notes and my pages. I every so often find myself going by a page here, and I look down one side and the other isn't there. But I did have a stop sheet here that says co-inherence, and it doesn't have a page number on it. That's my universal marker. Fated or chosen, in the end, the vista of future loneliness only allows a choice between two alternatives, either to despair in desolation or to stake so high on the possibility that one acquires the right to life in a transcendental co-inherence. Now that's a big load. One acquires the right to life in a transcendental co-inherence. But doesn't choosing the second call for the kind of faith which moves mountains? And that's all significant, although it's very much compressed. So I avoid the temptation to review much of what we were talking about last evening. There is one picture that many of us will recall that was used in a lot of advertising for one of the church appeals for helping people abroad, and I think particularly in the case of hunger. And, you know, the bottom line is, what appeal should we give to now? Don't we have enough appeals and not one more? Those envelopes, too. There's a very telling picture, you know, the old Chinese adage. I'm sorry I have to talk loud enough to be heard and too loud for her. She's not way down on the bottom of our totem pole. But this picture, 1,000 words, there's a small boy carrying another child on his back, and he says, "Heavy? No, he's my brother." And this to me gets at the heart of carrying another's burden. It starts with love. Hammarskjöld says here, this would require the faith that moves mountains. It requires faith. It requires the willingness to love and accept somebody else and say, "I want to take your burden into me." Just one more example. I remember years ago hearing that one of the young women in our congregation needed a kidney transplant, and it always moved me, it still does, when I see the mother who gave a kidney. Now, how can you be more precise than that in saying, "I am taking your need into me"? The mother had a kidney left, but it seems that God gave us two of things. So if you can get along with one kidney, but if you have only one, then something goes wrong with that. And this business of transplants is something still very problematic. And so the mother is saying in a very concrete way, I will live as you live. The same threat. And of course, in this whole matter too, mothers, and let us fathers claim some of it too, we have known over against our children how we take their fears into us. Somebody talked about the child calling out in the night, Dad, I want a drink of water. Really, I want Daddy. You get up, you bring the water. Some of us have held children who have been catching their breath agonizingly with yet one more attack of bronchitis. I visited a woman when I was a parish intern, seminary intern. She was about 80, and she told me about the boy, the little boy that she had lost 78 years ago. He was such a lovely child. Now, the extension is the question. I promised I wouldn't spend too much time on that, but in the Hammarskjöld material, the term we may find is the more familiar one, sacrifice. A little bit of background. We have the advantage of dealing here with a nationally, internationally known figure. Sometimes I humble myself by humiliating myself and asking, even publicly, do I know who the present Secretary General of the UN is? And I don't usually. The office has changed and the function has changed. Hammarskjöld goes back to that time when the Secretary General was not just presiding in an office, but he was going around, and Hammarskjöld was of the character who was, well, it wasn't shuttle diplomacy, but it was a matter of going around trying to put out the brush fires of insurrection and dispute around the world. And this is recognized in some of the memoirs. What is this? This is the one I want. Notice here, Servant of Peace is the title of a book. Unfortunately, of course, the brush fires are not all put out. They never seem to be. And the brush fires have very often become raging national, international conflicts. The history of the UN is not the issue here. But here was a dedicated man. He never married. The situation seemed to be something like that of the Apostle Paul, who was not opposed to believers marrying, but for him it would not have worked. For a Secretary General working up to 20 hours a day, as Hammarskjöld did, there would have been no time for spouse or family. Another element that enters in, perhaps more critically, to the religious elements of his life, is that he felt also compelled not to identify himself sharply as a Swedish Lutheran who on Sundays went to the Swedish Lutheran Church in New York and was noted as a member of the council and so on. That sounds like, well, I've got made now. I don't have to go to church because I shouldn't go to only one church. If I can't go to all the churches. So here I am. That's not the case, although I think there have been people who faulted him and said, well, he could have gone to church more often. You know how it is with a president. When he goes to church, this is made mention of. And his religious stance is a potentially divisive thing. Now, from the fact that Hammarskjöld was not an active church member, there have been those who felt that he was actively irreligious or anti-religious. His book, Markings, really corrects that. What we have in this book is a journal which he wrote over the space of a good many years. He had begun it also before he became Secretary General. These are very private things. They are also written rather erratically, perhaps because of the pressure of time, and perhaps also because he did not have anything to write just then. It is usually when I'm dealing with Hammarskjöld that I make an even stronger case for keeping some kind of a journal. I encounter students who say, well, I have done that for years, and I have found it very helpful. And I find others who cannot quite get the hang of it. There are some things to rule out. A journal is not a diary. It is not a day to record, today we didn't have meat again. Or today we had meat again. There are a lot of casual things like that. And the problem with a journal is they give you so many lines and there's an imposed guilt. Well, you know, you ought to be able to fill in 5 lines of a diary. What am I doing? But a journal says, when there is something that assumes significance to you, or a problem that looms, write it down. Why? Well, partly because we're likely to forget it, and sometimes we forget how clever we are. A journal will sometimes, as we reread it, give us the sensation that we are not so dumb. What we had written there was something that came out in an editorial, or even better, of course, in a sermon. We had the idea. But it is, to my way of thinking, a means also of doing an internal dialogue, talking to ourselves, not going bumbling. When Harold misses a putt, I wonder what he says. There I did it again. He would say it very nicely. Even on television, you suspect that the professionals who, not in the rough again, are walking all the way up to the ball saying something, but polite enough so that if the camera should catch them, it won't be lip-read through the interior struggle. But there is a productive dialogue. And this, I think, we see in Hammarskjöld. It's a lot of occasional statement. There are what are called aphorisms, brief statements, something like Ben Franklin's statements in, what was it called, that book he published?
Poor Richard's Almanac.
Pardon?
Poor Richard's Almanac,
yeah. Some of it he maybe came up with, and some of it he just wrote down there as in the public domain. Now, we put these things down, not just to see how many bright sayings we can recall, but because at a given point, something becomes more significant to me, and that's why it can be private and personal. And it may be some kind of a challenge. When I have students do journals, I tell them, I shall not call in all the journals and then have a few folks over at the house some evening and read and say, this is what the crazy things these students wrote. I say, this is to be your private journal. Of course, being a teacher, I have to have some evidence that they have written. I can't say, glue it all together and I'll feel it with a micrometer and say, well, that's thick enough for an A. But I do ask them to give me some of the progressions of what they have written, just a few pages, that way I don't have to read so much. I say, keep the private element to yourself. Occasionally somebody says, read it all. Doesn't bother me. But I am not going to invade. Markings has a lot of material which put in print discloses not only a more religious person than we would suspect, but sometimes a more troubled person than we might have liked to have as the solver of world problems. I announced, and did not really get to it very much yesterday, that we would be dealing with one of the foremost elements in Hammarskjöld's markings, and that was understanding oneself. He was not a psychologist, he was an economist and a diplomat. But he has, as the introduction says, a great deal of material. We will look at some of that, where he is looking for himself. I find it a little bit hard to live happily with some of this kind of inquiry, because I've lived too close for too long with too many students who would come up with what's now a cliche. I don't know who I am. I got to take stop out time and try to find myself. I don't want to be unsympathetic, but I think we are breeding a lot of an unhealthy introspection. There's one of these nasty stories about psychologists. It's short. On a university campus, one psychologist comes walking down a path, and another psychologist comes walking down the same path, and they meet and politely say, good morning, good morning. Then they walk beyond each other, and each of them is saying, I wonder what he meant by that. C.S. Lewis. You see, I keep bringing in some of these names, even though we don't have all the substance. At, I would say, an advanced point in his spiritual quest, says, I've been looking at myself too much. I've got to listen more to those outside. And he doesn't excuse himself and say, well, I am, as I did point out some days ago, a solitary type, a loner. There are many of us who are not really gregarious. There are some people who just cannot stand half an hour by themselves. Must either go down to the post office to buy a stamp or get on the telephone to talk to somebody. And if there is not something doing, they find themselves climbing the walls. And there are others who find that interruptions are the bane of their existence. They can tolerate loneliness. I think we all look with puzzlement and respect at the people who are going to stay here throughout the winter months, buried under X number of feet of snow. One thing, the old bell is not going to ring and knock your eardrums into the middle of your head, as the bell is covered with snow. But it's a lonely place. Loneliness can both afflict and bless people, depending on who they are. This is revealed in the markings. And now let me move on to some of his reflections. They will be fragmentary. I'll try to limit my comments on them, but as I say, they are just sort of dotted throughout here. This personal journal was by Hammarskjöld's sort of testamentary statement to a friend of his made public. Here, too, there is a difference, of course, between having all of one's thoughts made public in one's lifetime. Our public figures very often seal off their personal papers until after their death. There are some Mark Twain papers that have come out only quite recently. Some of it is rather scurrilous stuff, and we might not have been allowed to read Mark Twain if we'd known something of a pretty dubious attitude to God. He had a delightful way sometimes of retelling stories. Some actors here back in 1971 portrayed that, and it's a refreshing viewpoint on Adam and Eve, but it was not quite Sunday school stuff. And there was a lot of worse stuff than that. He was also very clever. When he was scolded by his wife for having talked to the neighbor lady while he was not wearing a necktie, he solemnly got a tie and said, "I think I talked to you about 8 minutes. You can look at my tie for 8 minutes, and then I will come and take it back again." But not everything is for public record. I thought about it this morning at Dan's little meditation after breakfast. It's pretty harsh, you know. Here first you hear about the golden-tongued preacher, orator, bishop, and all the good things he did. And then he turns over and he says, and he was an anti-Semite. Oh, my. Can't we preserve just the good parts? And I thought, well, we're told about the Apostle Paul. He tells us about himself, and he hasn't done too badly. For good or ill, we have the statements, then, of a very significant world figure. And without, trying to capture scalps for our membership gallery in the church, it is good for us to recognize that to be in the public eye does not mean that we lose a perspective on ourselves that is open to the working of God. Here, this is a neat statement. How can you expect to keep your powers of hearing when you never want to listen? That God should have time for you, you seem to take as much for granted as that you cannot have time for him. Now, there is still to be seen around that statement the explicit statement of Hammarskjöld. It's farther on, but this is all sort of non-chronological, non-temporal. What I ask is impossible, that life should have a meaning. So we can do a fragmentary reading and then sort of put everything together. And as I say here, there's a tremendous insight here. He cannot excuse himself because of his public busyness, saying, well, I just don't have time for thinking or reading scripture or hearing sermons. And yet, there's this peculiar thing. I'd like God to be ready on the international prayer talk to God line. And then if I want him, he better hear me. There's a perceptiveness here, and it is not something that has just been developed out of his immediate experience. It comes from his home, from having been taught hymns, having sung hymns, having been instructed, and the kind of undercurrent, the underlay of Christian faith and piety is a powerful thing to perceive here. I think those of you who've read Markings, I'm sure, have caught that. Sometimes we wish he would be more explicit. It seems too generalized. He makes a number of references to Jesus, and the figure of Jesus in a way haunts him. But he does not always explicitly use the name Jesus. And it can be a very bland thing. And unless you know about Jesus' life, you will not identify immediately. There was an adamant young man. That's the way he will speak of Jesus. The one who sets his face to go to the cross. And the motif of self-sacrificing living is constantly here. Hammarskjöld says it comes from a family of public servants. Now, again, this we tend to construe perhaps as motivating, you know, the kind of thing that motivates the candidates. Every one of them seems to want to get in the Senate or the White House. Of course, we've seen it backfire in the Robert Kennedy family. But there is what we might almost conceive of as an arrogance, that they belong. But there is also a good way of seeing, if we have the ability, there are places to serve. And I think we have all seen campaigns, whether for the school board or the city council or whatever the legislature in our state is called, or even for the United States Congress, where we are lacking the people who say, yes, I'm willing to take a crack at it. Especially the people who have it made in some other area. They, oh, I'm doing something good here. I'm going to take a cut in salary. I get some static. But who wants to go up to the state legislature and you can't do anything right? Who wants to sit on the school board and get all of that heat? The ideal of service is something that he is working with here also. But it is in the realm not so much of ego expansion as it is in simply serving. There is, however, an awareness on his part that it is very, very easy to feed one's ego. And one does then have to say, I wonder what I meant by that. I wonder what I was looking for in a particular action. He is judging himself. He is also judging others. But he is thinking about some of these things. And here is one little indication. A blown egg floats well. I understand that because I can remember when we were kids, sometimes around Easter, we would try to get a hole in one end of the egg and then the other and then blow out everything, including the yolk. It never really worked very well. We ended up with a broken shell and scrambled eggs. But some people and some cultures have done very well at this, and then they've sealed up the ends and they've done beautiful painting. But that's a blown egg. It floats well and sails well on every puff of wind, light enough for such performances, since it has become nothing but shell, with neither embryo nor nourishment for its growth. And then he puts there, in quotation marks, a good mixer. And that's a stinger, because he has seen in the circles that he travels a lot of empty-headed windbags who are good mixers. Without reserve or respect for privacy, anxious to please, speech without form, words without weight, mere shells. And that's the kind of an image that he finds himself afraid of in himself. And there's a good deal of basically healthy self-examination here. Let me go on to find some more in the same vein. Ego love contains an element of gourmandise which our language lacks the right cadences to express. Your ego love doesn't bloom unless it is sheltered. The rules are simple. Don't commit yourself to anyone, and therefore, don't allow anyone to come close to you. Simple and faithful. Its efforts to shelter its love create a ring of cold around the ego, which slowly eats its way inwards towards the core. Don't let yourself be touched. Don't give yourself to anyone else. In the midst of something like that, this is in general on prayer. We'll look at a prayer a little later. When the conflicting currents of the unconscious create engulfing whirlpools, the waters can again be guided into a single current if the dam sluice be opened into the channel of prayer, and if that channel has been dug deep enough. Now that's an affirmation in a different language of the value of meditative prayer with some depth to it, not sheer formal prayer. Now I'm into one particular area here. I have to sample because there's a richness here that simply cannot be exhausted in a limited time. At least be certain, he writes, in the marrow of your bones that it is not for the egotistical satisfaction of perfection in your job, but for him that you work, that what he has a right to demand from you takes precedence over what you have a right to demand from him. Now the hymns here are without capitalization, but I think there is an assumed capitalization. For whom do you work? Well, he's as high as he can get in. At this time he's not in the UN, but he's pretty high in government. Is he working for the king, or is it the king? I think it's the latter, the eternal king. For him, God, that you work, that what he has a right to demand from you takes precedence over what you have a right to demand from God. A couple of other references here. One has to be cautious, and I am not always that. Sometimes there is too much of a barb. I can say, of course, that I'm quoting, but I am choosing what I quote. And this is one of those potentially hazardous statements. My friend, the popular psychologist, and popular and psychologist here spanned with capital P's, is certain of his diagnosis and has understood nothing. Nothing. That's kind of arrogant. But I think it may be true. And he's talking here not about the professional psychologist or the counselor or the psychiatrist, but probably about the one who has read a few chapters in some watered-down, washed-out, out-of-wind-friends type of thing. And it's his judgment that there is no understanding here. Probably he was best advised by the age-old psychology of the scripture. All right, here is a prayer that I was sort of looking for before. The fact that it's down the line, as you can see me turning pages, does not necessarily mean that it was a new discovery. Thou who art over us, thou who art one of us, thou who art also within us, may all see thee. In me also may I prepare the way for thee. May I thank thee for all that shall fall to my lot. May I also not forget the needs of others. Keep me in thy love as thou wouldst that all should be kept in mine. May everything in this my being be directed to thy glory. And may I never despair, for I am under thy hand, and in thee is all power and goodness. Give me a pure heart, that I may see thee, a humble heart, that I may hear thee, a heart of love, that I may serve thee, a heart of faith, that I may abide in thee. That's not a bad prayer. Now, I haven't even bothered to look at my watch, but time to. And there might be some questions you'd like to raise. When I say look at my watch, I remember the old story. So many of my stories are old, but that means that they haven't been heard for a long time when they come from. It's sort of an ecumenical story about two little boys who were good friends. One was a Catholic and one was a Lutheran. And they didn't understand the differences in their church practices and their faith, so very wisely, they agreed that they would go to each other's church to a service. And first, the Lutheran boy went to the Catholic service, and there were, of course, lots of actions and symbols there, beginning with the holy water. And the little Catholic boy tried to explain this as well as possible and why they rang the bell at the Mass and this sort of thing. So that was a start. And then it was the Catholic boys' church, their time to come to the Lutheran church. And there weren't a lot of symbols there, but there were some, where the pastor stood, and boy, he wore that particular non-robe, I suppose. But then things began to get a little more interesting when the preacher got into the pulpit. And quite ostentatiously, when he got up into the pulpit, the pastor got out his watch and laid it there. And a little Catholic boy whispered, "What does that mean?" And the Lutheran boy said, "That doesn't mean a thing." Are there some comments or questions? I want to move on. I'm actually pulling two sections together. The promised one in today's title, a rather lugubrious one, on death and suicide, but not all bad. But comments on what I've been saying so far, further questions?
Sometimes when you're too close to a hill, it becomes a mountain, you know. When you're too close to a problem, it becomes overwhelming.
I'm trying to think of an image that follows along with that. Hammershold is obviously somebody who would have loved coming here because he loved to get away, loved to get up in the mountains, loved to get on water, but didn't get very much. Sometimes, you know, shucks, I can't get much vacation time now either, but he does appreciate that. And there's something I can't quote exactly, but he says you don't measure a mountain, you know, from down below, but when you're up there, then you sort of see dimension. In a way, I'm reminded because if you're close to a problem, it might look different than when you're into it and when you've moved along with it. Is that something of what you were thinking?
No.